Hi, I'm Ron Friedman, and I'm about to have a productive conversation with Mike Vardy.
It's always a pleasure to get to chat with Ron Friedman. I've had him on the program before, and this time we're going to talk about his book, Decoding Greatness, which has received rave reviews. Ron is an award-winning psychologist who served on the faculty of several prestigious colleges in the United States, and he's consulted for political leaders, nonprofits, and many of the world's most recognized brands. Popular accounts of his research have appeared in major newspapers, including the New York Times, Washington Post, Boston Globe, The Globe and Mail, Guardian, as well as magazines such as the Harvard Business Review and Psychology Today, and now he is gracing you and me with his presence today and having a productive conversation with me. He's also the founder of Ignite 80, which is a learning and development company that translates research in neuroscience, human physiology, and behavioral economics into practical strategies that help working professionals like you, like me, become healthier, happier, and more productive. I'm really excited to bring this conversation to you today. So let's get to it. Here's a productive conversation, my productive conversation with Ron Friedman. Ron Friedman, it has been a while. Well, it's been a while since we've done this publicly. We just talked for the last 20 minutes before we hit record. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Mike.
The book is called Decoding Greatness, How the Best in the World Reverse Engineer Success. And right out of the gate, I want to talk to you about this idea of engineering, because one of the things that I try to do for myself is I try to engineer certainty where certainty may not necessarily be apparent. And I've done this in my work with the idea of theming your days. We were just talking about this before, about like creating like a knowledge framework so that I know where things are, and I've had to engineer that. Is there, when people are trying to become great or decoding it, like how much of a role does not just reverse engineering, but engineering certainty where certainty may not be apparent? How important is that? Is that something that plays a role in this whole thing?
Well, I think that one of the things that is really critical to remember is that we don't have to create from a blank canvas. There are extraordinary examples in our field, and the better we get at recognizing those examples and then working backwards to figure out how those were created, the more of a map and I think that we can create for ourselves and really bridge the gap between what we're trying to achieve and how quickly we achieve it. And so the argument that I present in this book, Decoding Greatness, is that the stories we've been told about success are wrong. There are two key stories about that we've been told throughout our lives about how people achieve top performance. The first is that greatness comes from talent, meaning that you're born with a certain set of strengths, and that the key to finding your greatness is identifying a field that allows those strengths to shine. The second big story is the story of practice. This is the Malcolm Gladwell story, the idea that if you just have the right practice regimen, and if you have enough discipline to practice for an extended period of time, then eventually you will succeed. But what I discovered in doing the research for this book is that there is a third path to top performance, and that path involves working backward from extraordinary examples and then identifying how those were created to create a template or a map for yourself that you can then build on to evolve those proven formulas. And it's a path by which an extraordinary number of top performers have succeeded in the past. It's everyone from the way that Stephen King and Malcolm Gladwell learned to write, the way that artists like Pablo Picasso and Claude Monet learned to paint, and even comedians like Judd Apatow have relied on reverse engineering to study their craft. And so what I try to do in writing this book is give people the tools to reverse engineer the best examples in their field so that they can learn from those examples and accelerate their success.
Why don't you think people have been as aware about this third path? Because, I mean, I know I've done it to a degree, but you're right. I fall victim to one of the other two, right? Because they're louder, right? Like before we jumped on the call, we talked about like the noise factor that comes from opposing areas and how the middle kind of just is quieter because they're not as loud. I mean, the 10,000 hours, heck, Macklemore did a whole song about 10,000 hours. So, you know, it's in the zeitgeist of pop culture when he's talking about Gladwell's idea. But why has this third path been so hidden or, hidden from view or obscured? Or is it just something that has never really been kind of codified, for lack of a better term, until you've kind of put it in this context of the book.
I think people haven't discussed it because it's stigmatized. I think there's an assumption that if I study somebody else's work too closely, then I'm a hack. I'm right. going to steal someone else's ideas. But the truth is, this is how we learn. We learn by understanding how others have succeeded. And one of the things that really cracked this idea open for me as I was researching this book is a study conducted at a University of Tokyo that looked at what happens when people copy. And so the way the study was designed is that they brought in amateur artists into the lab. They divided them into two groups. The first group was asked to create original drawings for 3 days straight. The second group was asked to create original drawings for the first day. On the second day, they were asked to copy the work of an established artist. And on the third day, they were asked to resume their original works. And what the researchers were interested in is comparing that third day, group one or group two, which one is the most creative? Was it the group that just did original drawings the entire time, or the second group that had paused to copy the work of an established artist? And what they found is it wasn't even close. The third group, the one that had paused to copy the work of an established artist, was significantly more creative on the final day of the study. And it wasn't by, as we would assume, copying the style of the established artist on the second day. It was by going off in completely different directions. And it's because what happens when you study someone else's work very closely and you try to reproduce it is that practice forces you to compare your instinctive inclinations against the choices of a master. And because you're constantly comparing what you wanted to do versus what they did, that opens your eyes up to new possibilities that are hidden within your work. And so what that study helped me realize is that no, far from making us hacks and encouraging us to duplicate the work of others, if we can apply the power of reverse engineering, in fact, we will unlock our own creativity.
This is fascinating to me because I was having a conversation with a couple of my colleagues not even a week ago about dissenting voices and like dissenting. So expanding your mind and looking outside of what you would normally think in terms of whether it's political, whatever, and looking at them. This comes up in, and I know I brought this book up so many times recently, Oliver Berkman's new book, 4,000 Weeks, where at the very beginning of a chapter, he talks about Martin Heidegger and he says, okay, first off, this is the bad stuff that he did. And if you've known, I mean, he was not a moral person in that regard, but some of his ideas were strong. Like some of his other ideas outside of that idea of, I'm going to be a member of the Nazi party were strong.
Other than being a Nazi, he was a great guy.
Yeah, other than being a Nazi. No, but I think that what happens is we often dismiss everything out of hand because of that. And I don't necessarily sure. think that that's the best. I think, is there a relationship to that too when you were talking about like reverse engineering, like looking at, like saying, hey, you know what? I've looked at these other things. I've looked at what I know I like or what I know. Should I look at what someone else has done and that maybe I have a dissenting view of or I've never really looked at? Can that fall into this as well, or is it much better when you start to go down the path of, okay, this is something that I'm passionate about, I'm comfortable with, let me look at what they did and then reverse engineer from there?
One of the things I say in the book is that the alternative to reverse engineering isn't being more original, it's really operating with intellectual blinders. So unless you're using this, you're not going to be learning from different people in your field. And I think there's incredible value to looking at what your competitors, what your contemporaries are doing, because it's in that process that you discover new opportunities. And we live in a world now that is evolving so quickly that unless we're doing that, unless we're constantly learning from other people, we're going to get left behind. And so what I hope that this book offers people is our tools that they can then use to not just look at other people's work and get jealous and get angry because, oh man, I wish I'd come up with that, but instead have a completely different perspective, which is, wow, that's really interesting. I wonder how he or she did that and how can I learn that and apply those insights into my work. And so I think if you have that mindset of, man, I can now work backward and figure out how other things were created, whether they be a well-written email or the perfect presentation or even an exceptional website, having that tool to then kind of like pick the lock and figure out, okay, how was this created and how can I apply this to something I'm working on? That really opens you to new opportunities in anything you experience. And it doesn't have to be even work related, because what we know from the research that I discuss in the book about creativity is that creativity, as Steve Jobs famously said, is just connecting things. And so your job really isn't to try and become a complete original, because in fact, originality gets rejected all the time. You're far better off finding great ideas in different fields and then combining them in new ways.
So right out of the gate, the book is divided into two parts, but you talk about creativity. We've touched on that as we've begun our conversation. And chapter three is called The Curse of Creativity. So we've been talking about it in glowing terms, but then there's a curse element to it. Can you expand upon that a little?
Yes, absolutely. So we often conflate the idea of originality with creativity. And in fact, the ideas that are the most successful are not the ones that are the most original. Original ideas tend to get rejected, and it's because as a species, we tend to be distrustful of the new.
Right.
And that distrust extends to the way we experience new content or new opportunities or new products. We just feel like, oh man, I don't really know what to make of that. So as an example, I offer the Apple Watch, which is a very handy device. I love it. It was not by any stretch the original smartwatch. The first smartwatch was produced by Seiko. Then there was one that was put out by Microsoft. Those were out in the market over 10 years ago. They had many of the same features as the Apple Watch, and they were rejected because people just weren't ready for it. I also offer the example of Radiohead's music, where Radiohead had their first two albums were incredibly successful. People loved them. Then they decided to go off in a different direction, and people just didn't know what to make of it. Rock critics were very furious at Kid A. They just re-released Kid A. I tried listening to it again. I still don't get it. And maybe that's just me. I don't know. But the point is that, you know, this isn't just my personal opinion. There's research on this. And so one of the studies I cite in the book was conducted at Harvard, looking at the type of research, research grants that get funded by places like the NIH. And what they did was they took a whole bunch of studies. They had experts rate them on a number of different variables, including originality. And then they looked to see what predicts whether or not a research grant will get funded. And what they found was the more original idea, the more likely it was to be rejected. If it was completely unoriginal, that didn't get any funding either. The studies that got the most funding were the ones that were slightly original. And then I connect that idea to a quote from Don Draper, who in one of the episodes of Mad Men famously said, "Derivative with a twist, that's what people want." Mm-hmm. And in fact, that turns out to be true. And I think far from, you know, I think being disappointed by the idea that original ideas get completely rejected, I think that's really empowering, because what it suggests is that you don't need to hit your head against the wall trying to come up with a completely original idea. Not only are you unlikely to be successful, because that's really, really hard, but in fact, even if you were successful, your idea would ultimately be rejected. Your job is to take an established idea and make it just a little bit different. And a great example of this, and I talk about this in the book, is the story of Barack Obama. And how a lot of people just don't naturally assume that Obama was not a gifted speaker right out of the gate. In fact, he was a terrible speaker right out of the gate. He got trounced his first race for Congress. And the problem was that he was used to lecturing students as a law school professor. And out on the stump, voters don't appreciate being lectured to. And so he got trounced in his first race. He loses by a margin more than 2-1. He thinks that he might have to leave politics. He doesn't know what his next step is going to be until someone on his campaign team says, "Hey, why don't you go check out what pastors are doing in the church to engage their flock?" He comes back 2 years later, and all of a sudden he's using repetition. He's telling stories. He's modulating his tone. And the rest, of course, is history. And what I love about that story is it illustrates so clearly how Barack Obama didn't go off into the wilderness to find his talent. He didn't practice for 10,000 hours. He figured out what was working in a different field and incorporated it into his own, making himself just different enough from other elected officials to be unique. That's something that we can all apply to our field, regardless of where we're working. Just figure out what's working in a different field, incorporate that into your approach, and make yourself a little bit different than your competitors.
So one of the things that comes up a lot, especially when we're talking about productivity, time management, all that stuff, is this idea of being able to know where you're at, being able to measure it, right? Like I got to inbox zero, which is a measurement of productivity, sort of. But I mean, you can't measure that versus like writing a book, which is qualitative productivity. Sure, there's quantitative elements. I wrote this many pages, et cetera, et cetera. And you get into the second part of the book, you start talking about this idea of the scoreboard principle. That intrigued me because I like the idea of when someone says, when they put a word principle next to something that's math or numbers oriented, I'm like, okay, so this is both going to be quantitative and qualitative, and Ron's going to tell me how, and now he's going to tell you how. That's listening right now. How does that work?
So before, as you mentioned, there's two parts of this book.
Yeah.
The first part of the book is, what is reverse engineering? How do people do it across a wide range of fields? So everything from chefs to photographers to entrepreneurs. And then I show you how to reverse engineer and then evolve that formula so that you make it your own.
Right.
The second half of the book is about bridging the gap between your vision, the formula, in other words, that you've reverse engineered and evolved, and your current ability. There's going to be a gap there. And unless you figure out a way to upskill really, really quickly, you're going to get disappointed and you're going to give up. And so the second half of the book is all about upgrading your skills by applying the latest science to the way that you work.
Right.
I begin by talking about the scoreboard principle. And the scoreboard principle simply states that measurement begets improvement. Anything that you measure, you are likely to improve upon. And there are all sorts of evolutionary reasons for why this is the case, why we are designed to keep track of numbers. Just to give you one quick example, if you are out in the savannah, you encounter another tribe, unless you get a quick read on the size of that tribe, you are not going to make the best decision to maximize your survival. You don't know with whom to ally, with whom to partner or run away, mm-hmm. right? So you need to have that information. It's critical to your survival. This is why we are so attracted to numbers. It's why app designers are, obviously clued into this. We have all kinds of apps that have no reason for keeping score, and yet they use it. It's because they realize that if they force us to keep score, we're more likely to get hooked. We also know from the research that if you want to improve on, as I said it before, anything you want to improve, you can do that through measurement. And so there's research showing that even if you have if you divide people into two groups, you give them the same diet, you have one group keep a food diary, the group that keeps a food diary will lose more weight, even though right. it's completely the same diet. It's because they're paying more attention to their decisions. And so if you want to get better, the key is to identify what your metrics are. And so one of my favorite metrics, it's actually one that Cal Newport shared on his blog, is the number of uninterrupted minutes over the course of a day. If you keep track of that number, you're likely to boost your uninterrupted minutes. It's not just because you're focused on measuring it. It's because at the end of the day, if your numbers are really low, that's going to elicit shame, and that emotional boost is going to lead you to reinvest in that metric the next day. And so it all starts with figuring out what your metrics are, both short-term and long-term. And the critical thing is, unless you do this, unless you figure out what your metrics are, you're going to fall prey to all of those other metrics, like how many, LinkedIn followers, how many people retweeted your tweet. And so if you can develop your own metrics and identify the ones that are really in your control, you want to make sure that the metrics are in your control. That gives you a focus, and it gives you the freedom to ignore all other metrics. One other thing I'll say is I think that so many of us don't know what our metrics are.
Right.
And it's why we kind of suffer emotional whiplash where, you go on social media and one of your friends just bought a fancy car and now you want to optimize for status. And then a friend of yours calls you up and says, hey, how about we go out to this fancy restaurant? And now you're optimizing for fun. And you listen to a finance blog or a finance podcast and they're, telling you about the benefits of long-term thinking. And now you're optimizing for that. And so regardless of where you are, you feel like you're not doing your job.
Yeah.
And if you take the time to identify what your metrics are, I just think that is a far better path to not just success, but also well-being.
Do you think that imposing boundaries and knowing your thresholds is key to this too? I know I'm deviating from this a bit, I believe, but I mean, one of the things that I've thought is that the more you try to do, the more you spread your attention out, the less likely you're going to be able to succeed, whether you're trying to do creative work or whatever it is. I think that plays a role against greatness. So, I mean, what you're saying is we need to do a number on the numbers game. We need to say, okay, well, this is what we need to measure, and then we need to try to defer or defy everything else. That's a lot easier said than done, but are there other examples of like boundaries? To me, they seem to be important. Is that one of the elements that you go into in the book into greater detail, or is it just something that is going to happen when you start to follow through on some of the tools that you offer?
You know, I think that there's two different ways of interpreting that question. So I want to address both. The first I would say is that in the book, I talk about the benefits of keeping track of undesirable metrics as well as desirable metrics.
Okay.
So you want to have the kind of the counter to the thing you're trying to succeed on, because one of the things that often happens is you're so good at achieving the metrics you set out for yourself that your performance on something else suffers. And so one of the things you want to think about is, if I'm really, really good at succeeding at this metric, what are some things that can fall by the wayside that I want to avoid? So an example of this in the sales world is, if you're optimizing for getting as many leads as possible, you might be getting some really bad leads. Mm-hmm. And so having that kind of corollary of lead quality is going to help prevent you from optimizing for the wrong thing. So having desirable and undesirable metrics are key. The other thing I would say on boundaries is that it's really easy to say, okay, I want to just optimize these 500 things. And then you're spending 45 minutes filling out your spreadsheet every night. And you know, you laugh, but there are people who do this.
I know.
They truly are. And it's, I think this is useful to a point. And what I would just suggest to anyone listening is, if you can just start out by identifying three metrics that help you identify what a good day looks like for you, and keep track of those three metrics, that's a great place to start. You don't have to be bound to those metrics for the rest of your life. So it could be like, you know, as I mentioned, a number of uninterrupted minutes at work could be something along the line. Think about the thing that you hate doing that actually drives your success. For a lot of people, it's connecting with clients. Maybe keep track of how many client emails you sent out to reconnect with people who could be helpful to you. And maybe it's just something about, you know, like the number of minutes exercising. Maybe that just, if you could just work backward from your ideal day and say, what would make tomorrow successful? That'll give you a hint as to what your metric should be.
You mentioned the food diary thing. You said like one group that measures versus the other, the one that does it are going to, and I'm like, oh, that was me. I was both groups. One time I was the group that was measuring and one time the group I wasn't. And that's absolutely what happened. But I also recognize that I want to be in better shape, which is such a big, lofty, like it's hard to wrap your head around it in terms of like, this is what, there's not as much definition to it as one might need. So that, mm-hmm. what does that mean? Does it mean meditation? It means yoga. It means running. It means this. And I think that achievers like myself, and I know there's others, are like, okay, I want to be great at being in shape. So they don't, like, I know that I've run the risk of saying, okay, well, I'm going to do yoga, go for a run, do all this stuff. And I try to do too much. I think that's part of the process too, right? Is you just said, like, start with three and go from there. Is it maybe incumbent upon people, if they're going to do this and they're going to start to go through some of the tools and stuff you talk about in the book, is if they're going to try to be great in multiple areas, maybe start small in several areas, or is it do three things in one area? Like, is it, that's one of the things I think people try to do, is they either try to do massive improvements in multiple areas or massive improvement in one.
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I think that the bigger danger of the two is not having any metrics at all, yeah, which is fair. The default for 99.999% of the human population. I think that you're going to identify what your limits are pretty quickly. And I would just urge you to start small. Really, the reason I bring up the scoreboard principle at all is because I'm trying to help you figure out, how do I get good at that formula I reverse engineered? So whether it be, you know, let's say becoming a good speaker, creating some metrics for yourself that help you determine whether or not your performance was strong is really key, because now you can start to improve on specific features of your talk. The more metrics you have, like, for example, how many times did I say,
Yes.
That's a metric. Mm-hmm. How was my flow between ideas? How successful was I at memorizing? How effusive was I in my delivery? Those type of metrics will help you improve on your talk, as opposed to just saying, I want to give a good TED talk.
Right. When you were doing the research for this book, as we get close to wrapping up, what was something that surprised you when you came across?
Oh, man. There was so much. So as I mentioned before, the idea that creativity, that being original backfires, mm-hmm. the idea, I guess what I would say is the thing that surprised me the most is the extent to which reverse engineering is widespread. And so in just the first chapter of the book, I talk about Judd Apatow and how mm-hmm. he reverse engineered his idols. In his case, it was starting a fake podcast at the age of 15. I say it was fake because it was a radio station that was actually housed in his high school. And so he used this to reach out to agents and to talk to other comedians. And he invited all these other comedians on to the show. What they didn't realize was that it was a kid doing a high school show and the signal didn't go further than the parking lot. Yeah. But he used it to create a Bible for himself on how to write comedy. And Mike, you've done stand-up
well,
comedy.
Well, yeah, and I actually own the book, Sick in the Head by Judd Apatow, where he talks
That's right, that's where that came
interviews.
From.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
It's such a good book. And yes, I mean—
That is a good book.
Apatow is one of those guys where I'm like, because again, and when you're talking about originality and creativity, like when you watch Marvel cinematic movies right now, I'm like, oh, like I was watching the Hawkeye trailer yesterday with my son. I'm like, oh, it's Die Hard. Like, so it was like what they're doing is they're anchoring you with like, okay, this is you, we know you love superheroes. And mm-hmm. here's a like WandaVision was great because WandaVision went through all of the different decades of TV sitcoms. And I know that when they pitch things like that, because when I was doing comedy and when I was in the throes of working towards doing screenwriting and stuff like that, the derivative with a twist is very apt because you're like, what is this? It's like Pirates of the
this
Caribbean
meets that.
In space, right? Like it's so that
exactly.
way because they can get that, right? Whereas if it's something completely original, it's really hard because no one's seen it before. They're afraid of it, right? That's the other thing.
Exactly
too.
Right.
And you know, I mean, when this a lot of what keeps us from doing this stuff are biases, right? Like the biases that work for us and there's biases that work against us. Okay. What was one thing, like I know when I've done
hold on.
Let me
go back to that.
Go back.
I talked about Judd Apatow.
Yeah.
Right. But then it extends to musicians. It extends to chefs. It extends to photographers. It extends to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I talk about what their formula is. Mm-hmm. And, pharmaceutical drugs, it extends to weapons, and it extends to auto manufacturers where they actually have a Netflix-like database where they all reverse engineer one another's cars and then they share all the intellectual property, and it has lifted the entire industry. So again, far from making people hacks, it's actually led to safer cars and incredible technological innovations. So I guess that was surprising to me. I guess I thought, you know, this is something the marketers do. They read each other's emails, they figure out the formula is. No, this is going on in every industry.
What, when you're doing the research, because I love it when this happens, and again, going back to Oliver Berkman's book, I found myself doing like nodding a lot to what he was saying to me because it was the audio version. When you were researching for the book, was there that there must have been at least one moment where you were validated? Like it was like a yes. Cause I mean, you obviously went down the path of writing this book with some thoughts in mind of like, this is what I want the book to look like. This is why I'm writing it. And then you come across a piece of information or a story that says, yes. Did you have that moment?
Anyway, I had that moment in that study with the University of Tokyo. But I'll tell you something else that actually kind of validated this for me is when I read a story about how Kurt Vonnegut would reverse engineer stories in his field. And what he would do is he would graph out the protagonist's fortune over time. And so what he would do is that he would have on the x-axis on the bottom from beginning to story to the end of the story. On the y-axis is how are things going for the main character? Are they going poorly? Are they going well? And at the it was kind of like giving a story an x-ray where he would be able to identify what is the shape of the story based on how things are going for the protagonist. And what he found while doing this is that in fact if you look at all of the stories that have ever been told, there are six key stories that repeat over and over again. And just as an example, he talks about how the story of Cinderella maps on to the story of Annie. And so at the beginning of the story, both Cinderella and Annie's lives are going very poorly. Annie's an orphan being abused by Miss Hannigan. Cinderella's in the basement being abused by her stepsisters. Then something good happens. Cinderella gets summoned to, has the invitation and has the fairy godmother. Annie gets rescued by Daddy Warbucks. Then something terrible happens. The clock strikes midnight. In the case of Annie, she gets kidnapped by people pretending to be her parents. And then finally, at the end, they are reunited with their loved ones and they live happily ever after. It's the same story. And unless you reverse engineer it and come up with that story map, you never recognize it.
I never even thought about that. Like I there are some that are so obvious, like the Shakespeare, you know, 10 Things I Hate About You is, you know, whatever, Taming of the Shrew. Like there's a bunch of them that are, She's All That is My Fair Lady, which is Pygmalion. Like, but that one, nope, never even dawned on me that Cinderella and Annie were so closely related. That's stunning.
Huh. Yeah. And again, once you have that formula, once you understand what makes a story work, now writing your story becomes a lot easier and you don't have to follow the formula precisely. But again, knowing that formula and knowing why people like what they have liked gives you a roadmap that makes your work so much easier moving forward.
Well, Ron, the book is Decoding Greatness, How the Best in the World Reverse Engineer Success. There's talking in here about practicing three dimensions, how to talk to experts. We're not going to get to it all day because we want people to pick up the book, which, by the way, where can people pick up the book and where can they keep up with you and your work?
Well, the best place to go is decodinggreatnessbook.com. The reason I mentioned that website is because you could pick up the book anywhere, but if you send us your receipt, we will send you a free course on how to learn to apply reverse engineering to your field. And you can find out more about me at ignite80.com. And that's the name of my company. And the reason it's called Ignite 80 is because over 80% of employees are not engaged at work. And so our mission is to teach leaders and their teams science-based practices for lifting their employees' performance, creativity and success.
Ron, it was great to catch up and have a productive conversation with you today. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
Big thanks to Ron for joining me on the program. If you want to catch up on all of the things we talked about, other than looking in the podcast app that you're using, which I'm sure you have also used to subscribe to future episodes, we'll come back to that in a second. You can also find all the show notes at productivityist.com/podcast399. Now, again, you're looking at that podcast app right now. You're saying, hey, Mike, I am subscribed, or Mike, I'm not subscribed. How do I make that happen? You subscribe, and then you can easily access the archives of nearly 400 episodes. Plus, you'll get easier access to the episodes to come, including episode 400, where I speak to Dan Clark of Brain.fm. That's a really good conversation that you don't want to miss. I just love talking about things that kind of help you focus. And Dan definitely knows about that. We just talked to Ron about that. Now you get into another conversation about that next week. So subscribe to the podcast. That way you don't miss a single episode of what's to come. And there is plenty to come in the weeks and months ahead. That's it for this time. I'm Mike Vardy. Thanks for listening and thanks for supporting the sponsors of this episode, which you heard throughout the episode. Make sure that you support them just like you support the show. In fact, it's a way to support the show. So thanks to those sponsors and thanks to you. I'll be back next time again with Dan Clark for episode 400 of A Productive Conversation. But until then, remember to stop doing productive and start being productive. I'll see you later.